The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Zero Foxtrot isn't just a brand, it's a way of life. Founded and operated by veterans, Zero Foxtrot's unique apparel and gear echoes the grit of the warrior culture. Zero Foxtrot dedicates itself to producing content, honoring the sacrifices of forgotten heroes of the past, and connecting history to the present. Embark on a journey with Zero Foxtrot today at ZeroFoxtrot.com. It's not merely our products, it's about the ethos that we embody. Rugged, resilient, and timeless.
Okay, Greg, check this out. I learned something. I learned a lot working with you, but this one kind of took me back. Did you know that the cops don't have to find any drugs on you for you to be convicted and in prison for a drug crime?
Clayton, what are you talking about?
This call is from a federal prison. You will not be charged for this call.
We can say pretty confidently that at any point in time, there are over 40,000 people incarcerated for cannabis in this country.
Seattle Police with search warrant! Open the door!
I mean, we have clients who are serving life without the possibility of parole for selling $20 worth of weed.
That's crazy.
This call will be recorded and subject to monitoring at any time. You may begin speaking now.
The Gulf Task Force came to my house and raided my house and told me I was being charged with conspiracy to distribute marijuana.
Seattle Police Department with a search warrant.
And they didn't find any guns, they didn't find any drugs, they didn't find any money. But they still arrested me and they told me that I was being charged for conspiracy to distribute 2,200 pounds of marijuana with a maximum sentence of life.
And this is solely based off somebody else, just what they're saying.
Yeah, and they can do that without any drugs on the table. They
without
can do that.
Any drugs, right. Of course, yes, they can do that. And I'm a prime example of that.
Hey, this is Clayton English.
This is Greg Glad.
And this is the War on Drugs. Greg, what's going on?
Not much, Clayton. How you doing today?
I'm good, man. We got a little bit of a special episode today, yep. Right? A little bit longer than the others.
Mm-hmm.
Two interviews, Natalie Papillon with The Last Prisoner Project and Edwin Rubis, who's incarcerated right now. Where?
Talladega.
Okay.
Talladega in Alabama at a federal penitentiary
right out
there.
Yeah. And I can't wait for people to hear it because this conversation was it was a ride. It made me feel a lot of different feelings, anger. Upset, and you know, he really kind of just put you in his shoes, and I don't think we think about it. This is the first interview that we've had where we talked to somebody that's currently,
yeah,
in prison and
living with it every
day. Yeah, and you know, a lot of the things that you told me as we've started this podcast, I just saw firsthand in this interview.
Right, how we criminalize addiction.
Yeah,
how people get wrapped up in this. How you get the trial, going to trial, exercising your constitutional rights, going to trial.
Yep.
How that damages you.
Yep.
The crazy sentences, the problems in prison, how you get back. I mean, it really start to finish shows every little problem that you have in the system.
And it's so much bigger than anything you could imagine. Like once you once I found out that the people that really need to be locked up can give up lesser people and get less time, that feels like the complete opposite of what our legal system is designed to do.
Right.
But in actuality, it's perfectly designed to do just that.
Exactly. Because again, it's not about the drugs.
Right.
Yeah, and Edwin's case got on our radar from, you know, the Last Prisoner Project when we were talking to them and Natalie Papillon, who works over there. And, you know, it's an organization that does, you know, trying to help individuals that are currently incarcerated for marijuana offenses to be able to get released and, you know, successfully reenter society.
Yeah. You see what she's fighting for isn't just something on paper or just this it's real people getting affected by these things.
Yeah.
And like, the people is designed to, like, the cartel is not scared or the people in charge are not scared. I actually, you know, they enjoy this.
They like it.
Yeah.
Because there needs to be a scalp, right?
Yeah.
Like if you're
you got these numbers pinned to this person who didn't have a fraction of what we had to do with it, and they get to take the brunt and we get to keep operating. Yeah.
Perfect.
Everybody wins. Yeah. As far as the corrupt bullshit.
Yeah. No one loves mandatory minimums and conspiracy charges more than El Chapo and all these guys. I mean, who loved prohibition more than Al Capone?
Come on. Yeah.
So I'm really excited for you all to listen to this. We have an amazing conversation with Natalie, and then we speak with Edwin. And let's I think we're ready to get into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Natalie, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm excited about this. Thanks for having me.
Man, we're so excited to have you here. Doing the Lord's work.
Yeah,
you're doing what needs to be done. I mean, I think there's so many people that have been thrown away in the system for such a small infraction, and an infraction that in most places is legal or close to legal now. So can you start us off with just the scale of the problem and the injustice when it comes to marijuana arrest and who it affects?
Yeah, I think let's start from this misconception that now that many states have either liberalized their cannabis laws or outright legalized adult use cannabis, no one's being arrested, no one's being incarcerated for possession or distribution, and everyone who was formerly incarcerated has been sort of let free. The prison gates have opened. That is definitely not true. But we have done a lot of internal research at Last Prisoner Project, and we can say with, you know, pretty confidently that at any point in time, there are over 40,000 people incarcerated for cannabis in this country, which is, you know, a ton of people, especially when you consider the fact that 20 states have legalized for adult use and, you know, dozens more have decriminalized the plant. So we're seeing an injustice and a hypocrisy where many people are minting millions of dollars off of selling cannabis in their states. You know, they're buying pot stocks, while others are being sentenced to not just, you know, a few days, weeks, months in prison for even something as simple as marijuana possession. I mean, we have clients who are serving life without the possibility of parole for selling $20 worth of weed.
And that's crazy.
Whenever I tell people, they assume I'm making things up or being hyperbolic, but unfortunately, it's true.
And how does that happen?
You know, this one man I'm thinking about, Mr. Kevin Allen, he was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole because he was considered under Louisiana state law a habitual offender. Now, that seems really scary. And okay, habitual offender, like terrorizing our communities, whatnot. He had, you know, four previous arrests, and they were all for drug possession, all nonviolent. So we have these incredibly draconian laws on the books. We have judges and a judicial system that doesn't, isn't empowered to look at the full facts of the case. You know, they have to look at mandatory minimums. They have to look at habitual offender laws. And that leaves you in a situation where we have people serving life for $20 worth of weed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crazy. And like marijuana kind of just feels like it gets like thrown under the rug, but it is one of the biggest drivers of not only just, you know, criminal justice contacts through arrest, but also incarceration.
Yeah, you touched on a really great point. So throughout sort of the recent history in the U.S., marijuana law enforcement has ebbed and flows. But the 1990s, and, you know, at the very beginning of the 90s, we start to see a huge ramping up of marijuana-related arrests. So, you know, to illustrate that, in 1991, there were 88,000 marijuana arrests across the country. In 2002, we're seeing 730,000 marijuana arrests. So why did that happen? One is sort of the cratering of crime rates post the 1980s and, you know, what police have to do with those bloated budgets and how they have to utilize them and how they're incentivized to utilize them. And they do that by doing the easiest thing they can do is start picking people up on the street for weed, right? We also have this mythology start in the 1990s around the youthful sort of marijuana menace, right? So we have this idea that predominantly young Black men may have either been already incarcerated for crack or, you know, are not using crack or distributing crack as much as they might have been in the 1980s, and they're instead turning to marijuana. It's not just contained to the inner cities. Their sort of predilection for marijuana use is actually spreading into the suburbs, and I'm going to be totally blunt, no pun intended, you know, infecting white suburban youth. And this is a crisis, and we need to protect the children. And in order to protect the children, we need to basically stop, frisk, and throw every young Black man who might have a dime bag on them into prison.
Yeah. So you touched on something, and it's something that I've worked with quite a bit, you know, as states have attempted to either decriminalize or legalize marijuana, you know, you sometimes, almost every time, pushback from law enforcement. And what I've noticed is, like, it's not necessarily the prohibition of the drug itself. It's what comes around with it and some of the collateral issues. So it's like, well, now we're going to lose this thing that we have in our back pocket if we smell marijuana, are you, or we can do a stop and frisk on you and have a dime bag. If it's legal, those go away. Can you kind of touch on, like, some of the other collateral aspects of, like, what non-legalization looks like in those states and how that allows for government control over individuals through that and what they're losing from a legalization standpoint, the government?
100%. So you mentioned one thing about the odor of marijuana. So that's obviously been the case. That's been the basis for so many pretextual stops across the country. When it becomes legalized, and if it's legalized in the right way, police use that sort of investigative tool. I don't have a lot of empathy for law enforcement departments who say they basically need to skirt the Constitution in order to do their job, if I'm being totally candid. I think if you can't do your job and protect public safety without stopping a bunch of people for smoking weed, then you're probably in the wrong line of work. And oftentimes this stuff can turn deadly. I don't know if you remember the story of Philando Castile, but the cop who sort of approached him said he smelled marijuana, and he said that smell made him fear for his life. Now, this is a cop, you know, a young cop in Minnesota. That doesn't really hold water for me.
No.
But, you know, you can say that because it's illegal, and, you know, there have been so many court cases that say it's the, you know, basis for pretextual stops, and people can get away with approaching people and killing people because of that marijuana impetus.
That's just so crazy. Like, if you can smell like cocaine, then you are a kingpin. You are you're a cartel boss. You are Scarface. But weed is one of the only things, like, yeah, just a small amount. And like you said, people have lost their life. Like, for him to say he was fearful because of the smell of marijuana, it goes back to kind of the racial tones that it has. You're fearful because they've associated marijuana with Black people to make you fearful.
Yeah, it's crazy when you see the numbers as they just kind of stay in these horrible, you know, hundreds of thousands of people still getting arrested for marijuana offenses, mainly possession only, and still going on in 2020 when we're 2022 now. And so I know in some states they'll legalize it, but they don't make provisions to, like, make for retroactive sentencing for people that are in behind bars, or if you have a criminal record for something that's legal now, to, like, seal that or expunge it. So can you talk about some of the complications that we see within the criminal justice system now as we move to legal, that are still hindering people that were caught up in it prior to the legalization?
Yes. So oftentimes activists or policymakers will put forth a legalization proposal. They'll spend a lot of time thinking about tax rates, a lot of time thinking about, like, what agency should be sort of the regulatory body governing cannabis operations. operations, and they rarely, if ever, think about, okay, what happens to the people who either are still incarcerated or the people who were previously incarcerated and have this sort of black mark on their records. And so consumers, the general public, think, okay, it's legal now, everyone goes free. Whereas if you don't actually write that explicitly and do it in a smart way into the law, people are still remaining in prison. So they are in prison while they are reading magazines that talk about the latest pot billionaire, right? Can you imagine what that would feel like?
Yeah.
That's, you know, we have constituents who say, I was serving a 10-year sentence and I turned on the TV while I was in jail and I saw, you know, a conversation on the local news station about like pot moms and these like women making millions of dollars selling weed to like rich Beverly Hills moms. So there are a lot of issues with our criminal legal system. I think this is the one of the most obvious examples of just the hypocrisy and sort of the two systems of justice, according to like if you're white, wealthy, and well-connected versus if you're, you know, black or brown or low income, you're treated quite differently in a very literal sense.
With the two systems of justice, a lot of times for a lot of people that I'm around sometimes, it just feels hopeless. Like, what can be done? Like, I like to be a solution-based person. What needs to be done? What can be done at a state and federal level? What's some things that people should be looking towards or pushing for in their community to at least try to balance this out?
No, I want to be solution oriented as well. I think, you know, this is sort of table stakes. We need to have federal decriminalization and ideally federal legalization, both to sort of stop the criminalization of cannabis that's happening on the federal level. Now, we're not seeing huge numbers of people sentenced for marijuana on the federal level, but, you know, 1,000 a year. So we need to stop that, obviously. And that's something we can do just by a simple act of Congress. But also because federal decriminalization will set a tone, for other states who have yet to decriminalize or legalize, it will help it'll help policymakers rethink how they're attributing and how they're distributing those, you know, burn grants, those federal funds, so we can actually fund police to do work that makes our community safer as opposed to racking up marijuana arrest. Federal legalization, decriminalization is also really important because it will lessen a lot of those taxes, a lot of those expenses and capital expenditures happening for state regulated businesses. So they can, and that's going to incentivize people to move from the black or gray market into the regulated market and all of the good things that come along with that. You know, that's an increase to public health, public safety. That's something that's really, really important. We don't have people don't make moonshine anymore. Like, we don't have we don't have bootleggers, and I think that's a really great thing. But
I don't know if you've been to Tennessee lately.
You know, I will say my family is from Tennessee, and they have been known to brew a bat. But they have we now have craft moonshiners, right? The vast majority of alcohol sales are happening in a way where you can sort of track them, where you can make sure that underage folks aren't getting, you know, their hands on anything shouldn't be, where you can make sure that things are tested and regulated and so forth and so on. Just, it's a win for everything, for everyone. And that only really happens when there's federal legalization. So, you know, it's really hard to get this Congress to agree upon anything, but I will say the vast majority of Americans, Republicans, independents, Democrats, support federal legalization, and they support allowing the states to do what they wish when it comes to regulating cannabis commerce within their boundaries. And so we need to put pressure on Congress to sort of heed, you know, be responsive to the people you seek to represent or you're claiming to represent, and do this. And then in states that have yet to legalize, make sure that you're pressuring your state lawmakers to do that, right? And not only legalize, but do it in a smart way. Like, think about the long-term implications of the policy and make sure you're prioritizing those criminal justice reforms. And, you know, I focus a lot on the criminal justice aspects of this issue, but there are also real, medical and public health implications to this, right? So because cannabis is a Schedule I drug, which is a whole other story. It's a wild story.
Right.
No one can do any, scientists can't do any research, right? Or lest they be arrested. So we don't actually know as much as we should know about this substance that half of American adults will consume in their lifetime, right? And that's, you know, in a word, a little problematic. You know, some, you know, Israel's doing a lot of interesting research. There's some European countries who are doing interesting research, but there's obviously some medical efficacy to cannabis consumption, but we're not able to maximize that, or because we're, the Schedule I designation means no one can do research.
Yeah, cocaine, a Schedule II drug.
Right.
Marijuana, Schedule I drug. You can do more stuff with cocaine from
And that's crazy, because the weed that they do test is that same weed that's been growing at the University of Ole Miss.
Yeah. Since,
and we've had so many leaps and bounds with what weed is capable of doing now. I've seen that Mississippi weed. I've had it. It does not look pretty compared to what's out there now. And there's, so we don't even know what benefits there could be. And they're still finding more molecules, endocannabinoid system, all this stuff I'm learning. So,
yeah, benefits, potential harms. Like right now, we're operating in this space of no knowledge. And that's going to have negative effects for everyone.
That's what's up.
So go to lastmercyproject.org. Yes. Get active. Like you said, call your local DAs, your mayor. Seriously,
on the local, on the state, and everybody got to push for the federal.
Everyone. I mean, this should be sort of, Americans don't agree on anything. They do agree on legal weed. Let's make it happen, right?
Yes, they need to know. They need to know. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This is such an important topic, and I'm really grateful that you're spending time on it. It's something that a lot of people do not know about, and that's a shame.
We got a couple bills to pay, but we'll be right back.
Money, money, money.
Hi, I'm Jason Flom, CEO and founder of Lava for Good Podcasts, home to Bone Valley, Wrongful Conviction, The War on Drugs, and many other great podcasts. Today, we're asking you, our listeners, to take part in a survey. Your feedback is going to help inform how we make podcasts in the future. Your complete and candid answers will help us continue to bring you more insightful and inspiring stories about important topics that impact us all. So please go to lavaforgood.com/survey and participate today. Thank you for your support.
The War on Drugs podcast is sponsored by Stand Together. Stand Together is a philanthropic community that partners with America's boldest changemakers to tackle the root causes of our country's biggest problems. Like many others who experience addiction, Scott Strode was using drugs and alcohol to numb the pain. For him, it was childhood trauma. In his early 20s, Scott was invited into a boxing gym by a friend, and that's where he discovered the healing power of sport and community. In 2006, Scott founded The Phoenix, a free, sober, active community that uses the transformative power of sport to help people treat and heal from addiction. Scott Strode is one of many entrepreneurs partnering with Stand Together to drive solutions in education, healthcare, poverty, and criminal justice. To learn more, visit standtogether.org.
Waiting on this call from Edwin Rubus.
Yeah.
Get to hear his story, which is one of the casualties of the drug war.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know, Edwin Rubus is, you know, right now in federal prison for allegedly trafficking marijuana from the border to Houston on conspiracy. No drugs were ever found at his home. It was just people that were arrested said that he had been transporting drugs from... Okay.
This call is from a federal prison. You will not be charged for this call. This call is from...
Edwin Rubis.
This call will be recorded and subject to monitoring at any time. To accept this call, press 5. To block this call and all future calls, press 7. To reject this call, hang up now. You may begin speaking now.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi, Edwin.
How you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
How you doing, man?
I'm doing okay despite the circumstances.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. This is Clayton English and Greg Glaude. And, you know, thank you for calling into the War on Drugs podcast.
Yes, no problem. Yes, I want to thank you all for the opportunity to be able to speak on your platform.
Yeah, absolutely. I know we're short on time, too, so we'll get into it. So, you know, why don't we just start from kind of the beginning? You know, how this all occurred and transpired, you know, going a little beforehand and what the things that you were going through. So just kind of tell your story and then we can get in everything else.
Okay. Well, yeah. Basically, the Gulf Task Force came to my house and raided my house and told me I was being charged with conspiracy to distribute marijuana.
And right, they found nothing at your house, right?
Yeah, I mean, take a,
yes. When they came to my house, when they came to my house, and basically it was early in the morning, and they came and put me on the floor, ransacked the house from top to bottom. My son was traumatized by the whole event, of course. Yes. My pregnant wife was confused and just sat there. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't know what was going on at first until I was they explained to me what the reason why, you know, that was happening. And they didn't find any guns. They didn't find any drugs. They didn't find any money. And but they still arrested me, and they still took me down to the federal building, you know, downtown Houston. And they told me the charges, and they took me to court, and I was arraigned. And then they told me that I was being charged for conspiracy to distribute 2,200 pounds of marijuana with a maximum sentence of life.
Jeez.
And I couldn't really believe, you know, what I was being charged with. And I said, you know, I was shocked. And I asked, I said, well, where does this derive from, you know? And basically they told me that people...
This call is from a federal prison.
...the Drug Enforcement Agency, and that they were cooperating with the government. They were cooperating with the government, and had given them my name, and were saying that I was involved with them, you know, for selling marijuana.
And this is solely based off somebody else, just what they say.
Yeah, and basically the conspiracy laws work that way. I had to learn that the hard way, of course, and after so many years of being in prison,
yeah.
I've come to understand that if there's an agreement between two people that basically say or agree that someone else has been a participant in an illegal venture or illegal transaction of drugs, then that person can be arrested. Basically with the same charges that those two are agreeing that you had something to do with.
Yeah, and they can do that without any drugs on the table. They
without
can do
any
that.
Drugs, right. Of course, yes, they can do that. And I'm a prime example of that. And at that time, I didn't really know anyone. I had lost contact with the people that I had been selling drugs with. And so it was very difficult for me to say, okay, well, this Joe Blow here, you know, he's selling drugs, or, you know, this other guy, John, you know, he's also selling. I couldn't say that. I mean, there was no way that I could have given any type of information, even if I wanted to. So what ended up happening is, in my ignorance, you know, I decided to go to trial. And that was the worst decision that I could have made in my life. You know, I didn't know what the ramifications were going to be. My attorney basically didn't present any type of witnesses on the witness stand. He told me not to testify. There wasn't any evidence that I shown, you know, to try to demonstrate my innocence.
Yeah, no physical evidence. Nothing was found. I mean,
nothing was found. No, of course not.
And I
mean, if anything would have been found, then I guess, again, you have to understand that I was ignorant to the law. I was 28, 29 years old. And I mean, there was no way I could. I mean, I don't know how to basically believe that they could find me guilty, or that they could have said, "Okay, well, we're going to convict you based on word of mouth." And I didn't understand that. But again, I had to learn that the hard way, and I have learned that the hard way.
But most people think in the judicial system, if they don't have any evidence, what are they going to hold against me? And you know, you were just operating under the assumption that I think most people have, you know, most Americans have. And so really your only way out of the situation was for you to give somebody else up and continue this
cycle. Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly. And I couldn't. I mean, even if I wanted to. I mean, again, the people, the leaders of the conspiracy, the leaders in my case, I wasn't a leader. The leaders in my case basically had been arrested, and other, among others, and they...
This call is from a federal prison.
Cooperating in trying, you know, to try to get their sentence reduced. So here I come, you know, I'm arrested. I'm not a leader of the conspiracy or the case. And, you know, and I'm trying to prove my innocence. So the government uses all the testimony from them to basically label me as the guy that was in charge when I wasn't. And they know that. And even in my case, if you read the transcripts of my situation, I mean, on my case and my trial, you're going to basically easily come to understand that that's the case, you know, that I wasn't a leader. And it was kind of ironic now is that the leaders of the organization or the leaders of the in my case, have been released, every single one of them. You know,
the actual people that were doing this whole thing, making the connections, making the deals, doing whatever else, intimidating you, are able to walk free because they have, you know, higher paid attorneys, they understand what's going on, and they had information to flip on people that were actually less culpable in this whole thing. I mean,
yes, because of the reason that I couldn't cooperate with them and I couldn't flip, you know, I couldn't flip and snitch on other people. And that's one of the main reasons why, you know, I received such a harsh sentence. You know, I proceeded to trial and, you know, they gave me every single type of enhancements that they could have gave me. They gave me obstruction of justice. They gave me leadership role. They gave me a gun that didn't exist because I was never found with any type of weapons. But people testified and they said, oh, yes, he had a gun sometimes. You know? And that's, and they'll use all of that information to basically enhance your sentence.
Yeah, it's incredible.
You know, by now I have already done, you know, over 24 years and 2 months to the day I have been in prison, you know, serving this nonviolent cannabis off, you know, for this nonviolent cannabis offense.
Wow.
And I still have 10 years left to go.
Yeah.
But it doesn't defeat me, you know, because for the simple fact is, you know, yes, I mean, when I first came into prison, I was extremely depressed and I was distraught. And I'm still struggling with drug addiction. And, you know, the demons that I was dealing out in the streets, I was still dealing with them in prison. And to the point that it became very unbearable. You know, there was a time, you know, the first year and a half, 2 years was extremely difficult that I even tried to commit suicide. You know, I tried to take my own life. I couldn't face the fact that I was looking, you know, to my release date that was going to be 35 years later. I mean, my mother was... suffering, you know, and my children, my ex-wife, were left out on the streets. I mean, it was horrible. I mean, and there was nothing I could do about it. I mean, all I could do was call, you know, them on the phone for 15 minutes, just as I'm doing that, just as I'm doing that right now, you know, and talk to them, and didn't really do much for them.
Yeah, and this all costs significant money. You know, I work in criminal justice policy, so I'm aware, you know, of, you know, commissary items. It's the phone calls, it's the video chats, it's emails. They call them stamps, where you have to buy stamps just to send an email. If you want to send an attachment to an email, that's another stamp. And so, you know, I you know, we read about how you were trying to, you know, you're trying to better yourself in there and you're trying to go through college courses and all these different things, but you had to essentially choose between, you know, eating sometimes or sending an email or getting tuition books and things like that. Can you talk a little bit about some of those kind of struggles that you've had with that whole area of the prison system?
And I'm sorry, I'm just about to break down crying because, you know, it's just, it's so hard. You know, the times that I have found myself going through that and I had to make a choice, you know, to either, you know, purchase some things or, you know, or purchase my college books. But again, I haven't given up. You know, I haven't allowed my circumstances to defeat me. You know, I have tried, you know, through my faith and my perseverance to try to make something of myself, you know, despite being behind prison walls.
Edwin, we got people listening here. What is something we can do to help? Or what is something that people listening at home can do to help in any capacity?
The thing that I request for people is to sponsor me. What I request is for people to raise a voice to basically to say enough is enough. Why are you keeping this man behind prison bars when this man has been truly rehabilitated? This man has accomplished more than anyone could accomplish under those dire conditions.
Yes.
That's what I want people to basically know.
This call is from a federal prison.
I mean, it's unfair. I mean, it's just... I mean, people don't really have a clear picture of what a prisoner actually goes through behind the fence. And, you know, we don't, of course, we have different programs that show up in the violent, you know, notion or angle of what takes place behind prison walls. But, you know, they never really demonstrate the emotional turmoil, the anguish and the mental anguish that a prisoner goes through when he's being deprived of having that affection of hugging their loved ones,
right,
of having that social connection with the people that he loves. You know, those are the things that they don't demonstrate. And those are the things that I believe affects a lot of people behind prison walls. You know, you have people in here suffering from PTSD.
Yep.
You have people here taking medication. And, you know, you have people here breaking down sometimes and going to suicide watch. That happened to me when I first came into prison.
Yeah.
And like I said, I wanted to take my own life. I just couldn't fathom the notion that I was going to be in prison for 40 years. And it was just insane.
And that's probably compounded by the fact that you're innocent for most of the things, the gun and the hearsay, and they caught you with no evidence. So.
Or you did something that other people are making millions of dollars off of right now. It's an unjust system, to say the least.
Is there any way, do you want people to contact you or email? Or I don't know how that works.
Yeah, any other ways that, we can go out, or anything you'd like to say before we go here?
Yes, there is an email address that my brother's ministers, and it's called edwinrubiz@aol.com.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, we'll plug that in our podcast link, yes. And everything else. We'll put that in there, and so people can.
This call is from a federal prison.
Really, greatly appreciate you giving me the time to be able to speak with you all.
No, thank you.
It means a lot, you know. And one last thing that I would like to say, if you will allow me to.
Yes, please.
Is that the fact that, you know, when I communicate with people, when I speak to people over the phone, as I'm speaking to you right now, to me, that is oxygen to my lungs. That is life-giving to me. Because I come to think of it as a way of knowing that there's a world for me out there waiting on me, and that I'm not just here in prison and that this is my life. Because you have to understand the perception of living behind prison walls for almost 25 years and not knowing when you're going to be able to see society again. You know, by the time I get out, I'm going to be 63 years old if I have to do the remaining of my sentence. And by that time, I would have spent 34 years in prison for a nonviolent cannabis offense. And to me, that is harsh. I mean, it's inexplicable. So when I speak to people like you and I speak to other people, you know, from society, it gives me hope. And that is what keeps me going. It gives me faith. To know that one day I would be able to speak to you personally out there in the streets.
Well, yes. when that happens, yes. I'll be there, because I would love to shake your hand and give you a hug for everything you're doing,
man.
You know, and hopefully, you know, we can get you home a little bit earlier with all the, you know, support that you're getting out here. So,
we see what you're doing, love what you're doing, and we're going to do everything we can to get the word out. And
thank you.
Is there anything else you would want to tell the people out there listening? Or
I love each one of you. That's all I want to say. I love each one of you. Amen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Edwin.
Thank you so much, man.
Thank you.
God bless.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with the War on Drugs podcast.
Okay. I love Walker Hayes. He's amazing. He's so fun. Such a great entertainer. And that's why I'm so excited that JCPenney and country music singer-songwriter Walker Hayes are partnering together on a new limited-time men's collection for the everyday guy. The Walker Hayes for JCPenney collection is an upbeat playlist of instant classics with laid-back appeal and down-home vibes. As a dad of 7 kids, he knows exactly what fathers want and need when it comes to their style. This collection reflects his casually cool styles with outdoor-inspired details and versatile colors. Perfect for the guy living the t-shirt life or someone wanting some fresh options that feel just as good. It's easy to wear affordable styles that celebrate the ultimate family man, along with the quality, durability, and sensibility dads appreciate. Available online Saturday, May 4th at jcp.com and in-store Thursday, May 16th. Just in time for Father's Day. Limited time only. JCPenney, make it count.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts? Time ends. Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. And retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Bissell Pluma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Wow.
It's, crazy.
Oh, man. Like, yeah, that was tough. Because you hear it, but it's different hearing it from somebody in there, being reminded that they're in there. And then, at one point while he was talking, I felt it. I could see myself in that situation. Like, nobody would want to do any of those things he's describing for 1 to 2 years, let alone 24.
Right. And like the hypocrisy of it all, like, you know, this morning where I'm getting ready to come over here to the studio to record and we're about to do this thing. And, you know, I see it's like 9:40 and I'm like, oh, the market's open for the stock markets. Like, let's see how much money I've already lost. And cannabis stocks, I'm looking at them, and how crazy is that? That publicly traded entities,
right,
profiting off of sales of legal marijuana in this country, in Canada, and all over the world. And then there's an individual there that's in federal prison for 40 years.
And not looking at coming home till 2030.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. So that's, you know, as we think that we're moving towards a more equitable system, or legalizing marijuana is going to be, you know, everything's all good. There are still thousands of people like Edwin incarcerated at the state and federal level for things that are now completely legal.
Right.
It's just wrong. And hopefully, you know, things can change and folks like him can get home.
Yeah. And quicker. With people like us and the people listening, maybe we can, you know, change the course.
Yeah. I mean, again, call your congresspeople. Call the president's office, call the Department of Justice, like gin up support for this. I'm telling you, it does work and it can help. And so it's just a case that, you know, really, really impact me. I know it's just impact both of us just talking to him. So I hope that comes through. I hope this drives you to want to do something more about this and get bills passed, get people like him home. And so, you know, we can kind of move forward and he can have a positive impact in our lives. I think he'd be a tremendous value to society.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Make sure you follow the War on Drugs podcast so you don't miss any new episodes or any of our quick fix bonus content. And we'll be right back next week with another episode of War on Drugs. Until then, thank you so much for listening.
Executive producers for War on Drugs are Jason Flom and Kevin Wardis. Senior producer is Michael Epstein. Editing by Nick Massetti and Michael Epstein. Associate producer and mix and mastering by Nick Massetti. Additional production by Jeff Clyburn and Anna McEntee.
Be sure to follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Lava for Good. You can follow Greg on Twitter, that's me, at Greg Glod, and Clayton on Instagram, at Clayton English. The War on Drugs is a production of Lava for Good podcast in association with Signal Company Number 1. I'm your host, Greg Glod.
And I'm your host, Clayton English.
And thanks for listening to the War on Drugs podcast.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Bissell Pluma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Zero Foxtrot isn't just a brand. It's a way of life. Founded and operated by veterans, Zero Foxtrot's unique apparel and gear echoes the grit of the warrior culture. Zero Foxtrot dedicates itself to producing content, honoring the sacrifices of forgotten heroes of the past, and connecting history to the present. Embark on a journey with Zero Foxtrot today at ZeroFoxtrot.com. It's not merely our products. It's about the ethos that we embody. Rugged, resilient, and timeless.
Awards Watch says Liam Neeson is at his best. Don't miss In the Land of Saints and Sinners. Having left his dark past behind, retired hitman Finbar Murphy, played by Neeson, leads a quiet life in a remote coastal Irish town. But when a menacing crew of terrorists arrive, Finbar is drawn into a vicious game of cat and mouse, forcing him to choose between exposing his secret identity or defending his friends and neighbors. In the Land of Saints and Sinners, from Samuel Goldwyn Films and Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. Watch it now on digital. Rated R.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.